As if reading my mind, he added, "I'm the deputy chief of station. You support my station. Do you have any idea what you're doing?" "Yep. I'm running traces on your operational leads and answering other questions you throw my way. I just finished the farm. I'm waiting for my assignment." He stared and then sighed, just short of exasperation. He pulled up a chair and grabbed the sheet of paper. While drawing diagrams, he meticulously explained to me how the station worked. He listed the top agents and provided great detail about the tradecraft. He described the idiosyncratic agent network and the challenges the station faced. He outlined the station's relationships with the local liaison service. He explained how the station served a broad range of U.S. policy customers. He answered my questions with clarity and patience. I learned more from him in 45 minutes than I had reading for days. After his unsolicited but needed instruction, he concluded, "Your work here in HQS is important. We depend on you." "Yes, sir, thanks," I responded. And just as suddenly as he appeared, he departed. He was blunt, direct, and frank, if somewhat theatrical. He was also a decent fellow. He did not have to detour from his chores to educate and encourage a raw rookie. But that is what good leaders do. Maybe one day, I mused, there would be an opportunity to work for him. It was my first encounter with Kofor Black. We continued to cross paths in Africa. Over the next 2 decades, we would both rise through the ranks. He would command the CIA's Counterterrorist Center, CTC, and I would serve as his deputy. He would be my mentor and my friend forever. A couple of weeks later, another Africa field boss showed up at my tiny cubicle. Short and almost pudgy, he spoke in crisp, fast sentences. He explained that he was the chief of a small but important station with a well-funded covert action program. He explained that the station needed more sources, particularly among the many third-country targets there. Soviets, Chinese, Libyans, Cubans, and more were waiting to be recruited, he noted with great enthusiasm. "I have read your file. You are young and single. You did well at the farm, particularly in the recruitment scenarios," he added. "Yes, sir, I enjoyed it." "Well, I think you may enjoy it more in the field. I want you to join our station. The cover work will be substantial most of the day, but your agent meetings will be at night. I need an answer now." "You bet. I'll come. Thanks. When do you want me?"
"Next month."
"Well, sir, I'm scheduled to start the paramilitary course then, and I've had no military experience, so it will be useful."
"You don't need it. There are no wars for you to fight. We are all about espionage."
I wanted to take the paramilitary course, but I wanted to be in the field more. And, of course, I had no idea that in 2001 I would lead the CIA's war in Afghanistan, the largest paramilitary covert action since Vietnam.
"Next month I'll be there. Thank you, sir."
So I skipped the paramilitary course. I was the first of my CT class in the field. At the farm and at HQS, I not only learned the basics of espionage, but also gained greater insight into my strengths and weaknesses as a fledgling ops officer. Parts of espionage, particularly related to the hard sciences and hard languages, eluded me. My field tradecraft, intelligence collection, and writing skills were adequate and would improve. But of all aspects of the spy business, I excelled in the area most prized: recruiting foreign agents. At the age of 25, I landed in Africa. I immediately began spotting, assessing, developing, pitching, and recruiting spies for America. This was my life's mission, and I knew it. For more than a decade, I would serve in Africa, where I would meet my wife and where we would raise our children.
I had never imagined a family in Africa, certainly never considered such family joy on the continent, or such family love for Africans. These were unexpected blessings, because I had come originally for one purpose only. The espionage. Chapter 3. Recruiting. I do not like that man. I must get to know him better. Attributed to Abraham Lincoln. She screamed, "You will kill my husband. You will kill us all." Her husband sat quietly in the back seat of the small sedan. She sat in the front passenger seat. She twisted her torso to face me. Her hand gripped the seat. The other hand was braced against the dashboard. Her unrelenting, heavily accented English drowned out the rattle of the cheap, dirty car. I drove through the wet, potholed streets, wondering how to respond to this tearful tirade, while avoiding the roadblocks manned by drunk teenage soldiers on this sticky, fetid African night. Earlier that week, I had recruited her husband to spy for the CIA. Like me, he was a foreigner residing and working in this poor and violent sliver of a country. Against my advice, he had told his wife. She was brilliant, tough, and admirable. She loved her husband and children. Although she loathed her government, she clearly did not think her husband should be my source, my agent. She would not jeopardize her family. She did not understand how I could mitigate the danger, nor did she want to listen. She wanted no part of this. I pushed. I tried to explain the need for their help. I sought to outline the basic tradecraft that we would employ to keep them safe. I tried to recruit her. For almost an hour, I drove through the night, arguing, pitching, and cajoling. It was no use. The deal was off. After I dropped them near their car, I started another surveillance detection run and began drafting the cable in my head, the cable I would send to HQS the next day. I had already reported the recruitment. HQS had responded with enthusiasm and praise. I had recruited good sources, but this was the best, or would have been. The next morning I wrote the cable. I retracted my recruitment. What a professional embarrassment, and worse, what a loss of a potentially great source. A few months later I prepared to depart my post for another assignment in another country. I wanted to tell my contact, my lost prospective source, goodbye. We had not spoken since the spousal eruption. While we only met a few times in the assessment development stage of the recruitment process, we had forged a close relationship. He had spoken passionately about his love for his family and his country. He had spoken just as forcefully about his fear and his hatred of his government. The frustration gnawed at him every day. He was uncertain about what action to take, but he had confided that he must do something. He could not continue this humiliation. He could not condone by his acquiescence the sins of the regime he served. I told him that the U.S. government desperately needed to understand his government, to craft policies that would one day help free his people. Defection, I explained, would not achieve this. The United States needed strong, dedicated collaborators inside his government. And if he could prove himself as a valued, reliable source over the years, perhaps resettlement in the United States would be possible. He never asked about money, and I never raised the issue. That, I figured, would come later. He would have been an excellent source, I was sure. He was smart, focused, and brave. He wanted to spy for the right reason, to contribute to his country, his people, his family, and to right the wrongs of his brutal, dictatorial government. As with many of the sources I had recruited and would recruit, I sympathized with his plight. Most of all, I respected him. I owed him my gratitude for his trust, and I needed to tell him that. I needed to tell him goodbye. In the early morning light, with a rooster cackling in the distance and no sound or sight of cars on the residential road, I walked to their house. I had never been there. We had met in discreet locations. Except for our first couple of encounters, all our meetings were prearranged. No phone calls. I did not see any sign of visitors. It was a hot, steamy Saturday morning. This visit was a risk, but a reasonable one. I strolled quietly down the rutted, unpaved road, worried more about some mean and diseased dog than any hostile surveillance. They both greeted me at the door. He was happy. She was not, although relieved when I explained that I was leaving the country and only wanted to bid them farewell. I kept the encounter to a few minutes. He politely escorted me down the steps and along the crumbling cement walkway that led to the track in front of their modest home. She stayed on the porch, arms crossed, eyes locked on me.